KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. On today's show, the reason behind the International Latino Book Awards, a hit 80s movie now turned musical, and your weekend preview. I'm Jade Hindman, with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. For our arts and culture show, I'll speak with two people involved with the International Latino Book Awards about the significance of storytelling. Then Beth Accomando goes behind the scenes of Working Girl with Cyndi Lauper, plus your weekend preview. That's ahead on Midday Edition. This Saturday, Latino authors from all over the world will come to San Diego for the 27th International Latino Book Awards. My next two guests are here to talk about the significance of these awards and the future of Latino literature. Kirk Weisler is the co-founder of the nonprofit Empowering Latino Futures, which runs the event. Also with us is award-winning author Victor Villaseñor. You might know him for his best-selling book, Rain of Gold. His most recent book, Gathering Stardust, is actually up for several awards at this year's event. Kirk, Victor, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So glad you both are here. So, Kirk, I'm going to start with you. Take us back to when the International Latino Book Awards first started. What was the landscape for Latino literature back then?
Okay, great question. And jumping a little bit further back than that, if you go back to 1980, in the whole U.S., there was only 300 books published by a Latino author born in the United States. So almost nothing at that time. By the time we hit the year, the mid-1990s, it had improved, but it was nowhere near what it needed to be, with a few thousand books being published at that time. That, in 1997, my compadre Edward James Olmos and I co-founded Empowering Latino Futures and created the first Latino Book and Family Festival. We've held 78 of them since then around the United States. But the next year, we started the Book Awards out of basically the fact that mainstream awards were paying zero attention to diverse authors. And that's where we wanted to fill that void and create something so that then more people would pay attention to Latino books. Mm-hmm. And it has grown from like 11 awards the first year to where this year we'll be honoring over 200 Latino authors, books, and publishers from all over the world.
Wow. I would imagine that really helps Latino authors become more visible, right?
Exactly. There was a time where mainstream, the big five publishers, they sat there and they were looking for that next great unpublished author. Those days are totally gone. Today, they're not looking at anybody, unless your name's Michelle Obama or something like that. But everybody else, you've either got to go with a small publisher or various ways of self-publishing, and then either win awards or make significant sales for the main ones to pay attention. And the nice thing over the last 5 years, probably 30 of our authors, winning authors, have had major contracts with big publishers out of that.
Wow. Well, someone who's very visible is you, Victor. And your latest book, Gathering Stardust, is based on your own childhood memories with your grandmother. Talk more about the book and the inspiration behind it.
Well, first of all my books are personal. They're all about my family, and they're all nonfiction, and they're about familia. But let me step back a little bit. I started writing I had so much rage and anger towards racism, and if the Indians win, it's a slaughter. If the cavalry wins, it's a victory. And then all the racism in school, and then I flunked the third grade twice, and then I'm dyslexic off the charts. So I didn't learn to read till the age of 20. So I was called a stupid Mexican all through school. But then a Marine gave me a chess set just at the end of the seventh grade, and I learned how to play chess, and I became a chess champion. I beat all the smart students, all the faculty, and I found out that there are many forms of intelligence. I was very smart. I just couldn't read because I'm dyslexic, and nobody knew anything about that. The words jump around on the page. Well, I want you to know that when I decided to become a writer, to take all my hate and rage, instead of doing something horrible like revenge, I would write my story, the story of my family. So the people respect the Jews because they have a book. They respect the Greeks because they have Homer and all this. They respect every country has their own books and their own literature. And Alex Haley wrote Roots and got that all going for the black establishment. So I started writing, and my first book, I got 265 rejections before I sold my first book, because I write from my grandmother's indigenous point of view, and life is full of miracles. And my grandmother here on this book, she's on the front cover, and I'm a little child, she would tell me, she didn't tell about all her people being massacred and all these horrible things. Instead, how did she raise me up? She'd wake me up and say, look, there is the Father, Son, the right eye of God coming up. And look at the happy flowers turning their smiling faces to greet the Father, Son. Look at the trees' leaves shimmering. Look at the rocks getting warm. And then she'd tell me that every day is a miraculous gift from God.
Mm-hmm.
And then she'd tell me that I came across, that all children come across with their souls, their guardian angel across the universe, gathering stardust to help God plant heaven on earth, and that God can't do it without us, that God needs us to bring the stardust to help plant heaven on earth, and we've been doing that throughout the universe, that we're fabulous people. So I grew up thinking that all of us are so special, and we're God's helpers and everything. And then I started Catholic school, and when the teacher, the nun, told us that we lost the Garden of Eden, I said, oh, no, we didn't. And I, after I learned some English, this was not kindergarten, this was in the first grade, I finally knew a little English. I said, mm-hmm. We're supposed to plant heaven on earth. We're God's. She said, since you know so much, why don't you come up here and say it? So I went up to the classroom and I said, all of us are wonderful people. There's only one race, the human race, and we come across the stars gathering stardust to plant heaven on earth. And the nun started listening. Then she realized I was contradicting everything about sin and everything. So she yelled, jumped up and grabbed me and said, that's all stupid Indian superstition. And she slapped me and slapped me. And those seeds are what helped me become a writer. When I had this beautiful story that we're all good people and I wasn't going to quit, and when I got beaten up and horrible Floyd at school, I finally learned how to read at the age of 20, I decided to become a writer and bring to the world that women are our natural leaders, that children are angels,
yeah,
that men are heroes,
yeah,
and that women, why they're natural leaders is because, you see, a woman can pull on the rope
Indeed.
And give birth and blood yeah. and all that and instantly be nursing
right.
again.
I mean, all of your writing is so deeply personal and spiritual. Victor, I want to pull you in here because I want to ask you, you know, what makes San Diego a unique and special place for Latino literature?
a variety of things, and largely because of the Latino population here, you have recent arrivals, and you have people that have been here 300-400 years, and that within the Latino community. So you have those variety of experiences, variety of type of books. With our book awards, we have 87 different categories to really play up all the diverse kinds of books. And at the American Library Association convention each year, we'll have a librarian come up and they go, oh, do you have books in this or that type of category? And mm-hmm. we go, no problem. We got you covered.
Got it.
And that's why we have the categories so that then there is that diversity. But here, it's a real hotbed, in part because of our climate, for those authors that maybe were born elsewhere and wanted to live in a nicer place, as well as those that grew up here, because we certainly have authors that started their life as a farm worker. And now they're writing books and stuff along those lines.
Yeah. Well, Victor, what sorts of inspiration do you continue to draw from San Diego?
Well, one thing I want to say about Kurt Whistler, his organization has been the thing that has helped us. I was all alone. You know, I said 265 rejections. And I was fighting with New York and publishers. And they don't believe in miracles, and they don't believe in the Mexican culture or the indigenous culture. And then when he comes along and starts all this up, I was finally not alone anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We have here a huge opportunity to bring world harmony, world understanding. Our president in Mexico right now is a woman. She's Jewish, and she was elected in an all-male-based country. And what has she done? She said that indigenous people are the foundation of Mexico, where wealthy people, even my own relatives that are educated in Mexico, they look down their nose on indigenous people. She does not. And she has said that being a mother, being a housewife is a profession, and she's giving them benefits. She's turning things around for women. That's so fantastic. And mm-hmm. women are coming to her. Now in New Zealand, we have a woman running things, and we're having Latina women, and she's bringing them together. What is Mexico? It's full of heart, and that's what we bring to this country, and that's what the planet needs. To give heart, have compassion.
And it's just a matter of completely changing the narrative. And Kirk, you know, visibility can do that. So tell me, you know, how is visibility for Latino stories especially important in this current political moment?
And it has just been in the last 3 years that mainstream attention has really uniformly started to pay attention. Before, we'd have one or two book publishers paying attention. But now with what's happening under the current administration and ICE and all of that, we're in a situation where it's now more important than ever. And actually, since Trump took office, I've had 4 people ask me, are you going to change the name of your organization from Empowering Latino Futures? And I go, no, we're going to emphasize it all the more because that's what it's all about. And that, because empowering others is so key. One of the things, if you're an author out there and you want to find a way into this profession, mm-hmm. and in my mind, almost everybody has a book inside of them, how to get it out. Go to latinobooks.org, and you can learn about our event this weekend, about all our various author programs. We have the International Society of Latino Author Programs, headed by Galilea Flores, that are very key. We still have a few more tickets for Saturday's event. If anybody wants it, once again, go to latinobooks.org.
Well, in the last few minutes that we have here, Victor, what is your hope for the future of storytelling and Latino books and stories?
Well, let me tell you this, which I'm smiling, big grin. Raina Gold, everybody's saying, make it a movie, make it a movie, make it a series. We're finally closing a deal with Sherry Marsh, who did The Vikings, who's one of the strongest women producers in all of Hollywood. She's been coming to my home for 10 years, bringing her husband and kids, and we're finally closing a deal. And Lion Eyes, another book of mine, is in production right now. We need to bring heart. We need to get out of our cautious heads and get into our hearts and have compassion. And the only people that are going to do that are women. And all my stories are about women and miracles.
Wow. Kirk?
Yeah. Just wanted to draw to everybody's attention. In terms of our awards this year, took 222 judges to judge all those different books that came in. And so their insights, when you're seeing these winning books, it really is a great way to see what has already been pre-screened for you.
All right. I've been speaking with Kirk Whistler, co-founder of Empowering Latino Futures, and Victor Villaseñor, author of Gathering Stardust. The International Latino Book Awards will take place this Saturday at the MiraCosta College Concert Hall. For more information, go to latinobooks.org. We'll also have those details on our website, kpbs.org. Kirk, Victor, it's been a pleasure. And Victor, you have such an amazing story. Keep telling it.
Thank you. Ay, ay, ay. Women are the future of the world.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, Beth Accomando goes behind the scenes of an upcoming La Jolla Playhouse production with Cyndi Lauper.
When I was a kid, like 4 or 5, I was singing all my mother's Broadway albums. That was how I played. I wasn't just Eliza Doolittle. I was also her father.
Oh, hear more when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Bilhau Plumbing, Heating, and Air Restoration and Flood Services. Family-owned and operated over 4 decades, Bilhau has been serving the plumbing, heating, and air and water damage needs of the San Diego area since 1980. With their fleet of trained professionals, Bilhau has the ability to service all major and minor plumbing and HVAC emergency needs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Bilhau is committed to providing excellent service to their customers with transparent quotes and attention to detail on every job. Whether you're in need of an HVAC installation, plumbing, or water damage restoration in San Diego, they offer the convenience of scheduling an appointment over the phone, online, or through live chat on their website. Call 1-800-BILHOW or visit bilhau.com, because we know how.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Working Girl was a hit 80s movie that is being reimagined as a musical for the La Jolla Playhouse. Pop rock artist Cyndi Lauper tackled her first movie to musical in 2012 to bring Kinky Boots to Broadway. Well, now she teams with book writer Teresa Rebeck and director Christopher Ashley to bring Working Girl to the Playhouse stage. KPBS arts reporter Beth Accomando speaks with the three creators about their collaborative process and love of Broadway musicals.
To begin with, who wants to give me a little origin story on how this Working Girl musical started?
We were all minding our own business. And then I met Kevin Wade, and my agent was also Chris's agent, and I got hired to do the music, and I thought it would be a good idea because, you know, how much fun that would be to recreate 80s sounds and things that were so exciting at the time. And also the whole experience of working together in a theatrical project is such a community, and it's like the largest collaboration you could possibly do because you're collaborating with so many people. But to be able to collaborate with a woman writer, which I've never been able to do, not enough, not in music or in, and I've never done it in this, but I thought would be so much fun. And Chris, his agent, was my agent. So that's how I met Chris. And we met, what, 2015?
Yeah, 10 years ago.
Oh my God, I'm growing old by the second.
And then Teresa joined us 3 years ago and really has been like everything's really started to gel in beautiful new ways when Teresa joined the team. In fact, Teresa and I, we worked together one time before in the 80s. So it is a beautiful full circle that we're back together collaborating.
And what'd you do? What'd you do?
Bike heels. Yeah. Another story about a woman having a hard time, but fighting for her dream.
So, Cindy, what attracted you to working on a Broadway musical in the first place? This is your second one. You had a wildly successful career already. So what made it attractive to try this?
Being in the music industry after a while was frustrating because you had to be one thing. First, they said, well, you're an icon and you can't sing like that. Or you're not a celebrity, you're an artist, or you're too much of a celebrity. And, you know, whatever the hell, it was back and forth. And it was a pain in the ass. And then Harvey called me up one day and I had just done a tour through Europe. And it was almost like, well, if you tour through Europe, you can prove that you're a rocker. And I was like, are you freaking kidding me? So when Harvey called me, I was like, yeah, I'm ready. Because once I started doing it, I remembered that when I was a kid, like 4 or 5, I was singing all my mother's Broadway albums. That was how I played.
Just you wait, Henry Higgins, just you wait. You'll be sorry, but your tears will be too light.
I like became all these people. I think at 8, I wasn't just Eliza Doolittle. I was also her father. I was everybody. And so when writing this stuff, it just became more natural to do and fun. And, you know, look at me now. I get to work with Teresa Rebeck, Chris Ashley, all these people. And I also brought, because it's 80s, I brought Rob Hyman in, who I wrote Time After Time with, and Sammy James Jr., who wrote the title track for the movie School of Rock and also was used in the musical. And he also was on my team in Kinky Boots, a really wonderful writer. And we got Cheryl from Salt and Pepper Salt to do a little rap in the second number of the show. So it's very 80s. And it was an extraordinary time musically and a very hopeful time, as Teresa brought up before, that it was a time of challenge and opportunity.
I just wanted to say, you know, I've really never worked in this space either. And so you do have to be invited in. I'm really grateful to Chris, who's been doing this for so long, and we have known each other a long time, but we took very different paths. I ended up doing a lot of straight plays. He ended up doing a whole lot of musicals and other things as well. But you have to be sort of invited in when people want to break open your world and say, do you want to try this? So there's, you know, there's a moment, like this project has got a lot of hope and dreaming in it from the source material. And I was grateful to be invited in. But Chris, you know, that there's like somebody believes in you and you grab onto that belief. And that's that's been really one. And also to be invited into a world that Cyndi Lauper was writing the music for was really important to me. I can't say it wasn't influential in me going, yeah, I want to do that. But it was both Cyndi's importance to me and my life story, and also Chris's importance to me as a fellow artist and somebody who believed that I could do this, that those things became like crucial to the building of the project, which is very much about hoping and dreaming. Cindy's got a lot of lyrics about that are so meaningful to me. Like there's a moment in one song where she's has this person say, big dreams come from little people. And it just hits me every time because I think that's been true for me. And I love hearing it articulated over and over and over again. And it's at the heart and soul of this. So I'm grateful to be here for sure.
And just following up on that, I mean, I think there's been so much kind of, there's so much joy in the story that we're telling. There's so much kind of infectious, you make you want to dance in the score. There's so much heart in the work and the lyrics and the book of this. We've just added Sarah Oglebe, our choreographer, because as we are beginning to stage, and Sarah and I did watch hours and hours of 80s MTV videos together, which have absolutely inspired some of the dance and quite a lot of the video backgrounds as well.
And in keeping it in the 80s, how would you describe the tone in the sense of, is it nostalgia, but also mixed with a little sense of things haven't changed as much as maybe they should? Like, what's kind of the balance between making it feel that it resonates with an audience today and also kind of tapping into that nostalgia feel?
Looking at you, you were in the 80s too. You remember what that was like. And I think that people should remember what it was like and compare it to what it's like now. And you might find, yeah, maybe not so much has changed. But the one thing, what Teresa said, there was hope. As Harvey Milk said, people need hope. You got to give people hope. So I'm excited because this, hopefully, will be inspiring and hopeful. You want to make people laugh and cry and stand up and you know, be hopeful. And I think that as long as we make a little happy pill for them, it's going to be good.
It also is a story that only could happen in the 80s, right? Like the Tess impersonates a high-powered executive in the world of Google. She wouldn't get very far before she was discovered. The 80s do a lot for us in the pre-internet way.
Yeah, now we live on social media. Everything can be looked up.
And for all of you, Cindy, you alluded to a little of this, but like, what role did Broadway musicals play for you when you were young, when you were growing up? Were they things that you felt you ever wanted to do? Or was it just something like from your parents? I'm just curious, like, what role that might have played in your lives.
That's how I played when I was little. I destroyed my mother's records, I gotta admit. I played The King and I so many times that my grandmother, we lived mother-daughter house. She came downstairs and she took the record off of my little red record player and she didn't say a word. She just went upstairs with it. And that was the last time I saw that record because I played and sang so many, you know, but you got to understand, I was imitating the voices. You got to really listen to that stuff. But, you know, I was like five. So she was going to kill me, I think. And, you know, Barbra Streisand, funny girl, forget it. I was so close to Barbara. I was on the other side of her. You know, that's how I was growing up. You know, I would imitate her all the time. And then once the Beatles and the Supremes came along and they had albums that said, meet the Beatles, meet the Supremes. In my mind, I thought, ooh, I met them. I like them. I'm going to play with them now. It wasn't that foreign to me because I was Rex Harrison and also Julie Andrews. I was those two people.
Teresa, you want to do that one?
No, I don't want to do that one.
You didn't play in the plays when you were little.
Listen, I grew up on student matinees at Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. And honestly, I almost killed myself one time because I didn't want to tell my mom that I wasn't feeling good, because if I did, she would have kept me home from, I would have had to go to the doctor because I hadn't been feeling good the day before. And I didn't want to tell her that because I was going to a student matinee. I can't even remember which one it was, but I saw a lot of great stuff. Anyway, the end of that story is I came home and I said, I really don't feel good. And they took me to the doctor and I ended up having my appendix taken out like within an hour. I almost gave myself sepsis because I wanted to see like The Tempest so bad. But so for me, there was that kind of real passion for the theater. It just never got translated into the musical side of things. So that's partially why I'm like really just so, my mind is blown right now about what we're doing. It's in a great way.
I love that. I was I grew up for a while in upstate New York, and I would visit my grandparents who lived in the city, and they would take me to three or four shows on Broadway, whatever was available on TKTS. The first show I saw was Chorus Line from the balcony all the way on the side. When we moved, Memphis was my first show I did at La Jolla when I got here, to the Schubert Theater where Chorus Line was. I went and sat in that same seat that was the first show I had ever seen on Broadway and had a complete joy breakdown.
And Chris, how does this feel to have this play be your final play here at the Playhouse?
It feels so good. I wish I could say that I had really planned it carefully and well, but it was like the stars coming together that after 10 years of development, this show was ready at exactly this time. But I can't imagine a show I'd rather go out on.
Aww.
And you mentioned that musicals take a long time to finally get on stage. Did this change in any significant way in terms of how it was conceived or the kind of evolution? What changed, Chris? You're shaking your head.
It changed every minute up to and including today and tomorrow. Like it's been an aggressive and joyous rewrite process every minute, and it will continue right up through opening night and beyond.
I mean, isn't it great that there is a place like La Jolla where you can, I mean, this is the first time this thing is being put up on its feet. We've never seen it on its feet. So it's exciting. And the fact that there's a place like La Jolla to try these things out and see what you need to do is really great.
That was Beth Accomando speaking with Cindy Lauper, Teresa Rebeck, and La Jolla Playhouse Artistic Director Christopher Ashley. Working Girl, a world premiere musical, will open October 28th and run through December 7th at La Jolla Playhouse. Still to come, Julia Dixon Evans joins me with a preview of this weekend's arts events. Midday Edition is back after the break.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Bilhaugh Plumbing, Heating, and Air Restoration and Flood Services. Family-owned and operated over four decades, Bilhaugh has been serving the plumbing, heating, and air and water damage needs of the San Diego area since 1980. With their fleet of trained professionals, Bilhaugh has the ability to service all major and minor plumbing and HVAC emergency needs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Bilhaugh is committed to providing excellent service to their customers with transparent quotes and attention to detail on every job. Whether you're in need of an HVAC installation, plumbing, or water damage restoration in San Diego, they offer the convenience of scheduling an appointment over the phone, online, or through live chat on their website. Call 1-800-BILHAUGH or visit bilhaugh.com, because we know how.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. For many artists and art lovers, conventional art fairs can feel a bit out of reach and expensive. But one project hopes to disrupt that. The Other Places Art Fair South, or OPAF, will bring local artists and art spaces together in Escondido on Saturday. Here in San Diego, the event is co-organized by Harvest and Gather, a curatorial project of Kat Gunn and Mika Castaneda. KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans recently sat down with Gunn to talk about the fair. Here's that conversation.
Kat, can you tell me a little bit about the origins of Other Places Art Fair?
Yeah, I can certainly try. So Other Places Art Fair is another project that's run by Kay Niddle and based out of LA San Pedro area. So really, it's this alternative to the art fair structure that brings in projects that go beyond the White Cube Gallery space in the commercial art world, really. So thinking about grassroots movements, hard-to-find projects, fluid projects, things that are maybe a little bit more unconventional for the White Cube can gather at this art fair structure. And they just had their seventh version this past September. So me and my collaborator, Mika Castaneda, participated last year, September 2024. And we were just so excited because it was like the art fair version of our curatorial project. Mm-hmm. And we just, through asking a couple of questions, were like, Kay, would you ever come down to San Diego, and she said yes. She runs a version in Santa Rosa called OPAC North. She even goes as far as Tokyo. So we're really excited that it's coming much closer to San Diego for the first version of OPAC South this weekend.
Before I get to talking about Harvest and Gather, your curatorial project, I want to ask a little more about that White Box Gallery contemporary art fair culture. Like, for those of us not that versed in that, what is it about those sort of art fairs that Other Places is trying to counter?
Mm-hmm. I think one thing is accessibility that mm-hmm. really sticks out to me. So with an art fair, it is generally like you see the images, it's a ton of booths, there's a ton of galleries, and maybe other projects there too, but it's really quite expensive to get there. And then when you think about all the people that those art fairs bring in, then you think about the cost of like all these people traveling for basically a convention in one city. Mm-hmm. There's even models of art fairs that are marketing themselves as affordable art fairs, and you're still paying $1,000 to $3,000 to participate in those. Mm-hmm. With Other Places Art Fair, it feels a lot more accessible because you're not paying more than just like 300 baby to really participate. And the fees that you pay for applying and for your booth go straight back into running the fair and paying people who are also artists who run the fair, right? Mm-hmm. Like artists need jobs that are more than just teaching or studio work. Like there's always like a side gig that an artist is trying to pick up. And it's another way that they get to interact and kind of like not just provide for themselves, but support their community as well. So there's something about the art fair structure that feels like a really, really expensive shopping mall to me. Mm-hmm. And I really love the more authentic, sincere take that Other Places offers.
Can you talk about Harvest and Gather? This is your collaborative curatorial project with Mika Castaneda. You've recently had work in the Athenaeum, but also tons of smaller art spaces, a lot of artist-run spaces in San Diego and beyond. What motivates your work?
We really started Harvest and Gather because although we're a nomadic project in that we don't have a physical space, we didn't want the limitations of living in a city where it would be really expensive to basically rent a gallery space to stop us from being able to make really thoughtful shows. And ultimately, as curators, we always are thinking about curating as a gesture that comes from this place of care. We are also artists ourselves, and the project is kind of an extension of our modular installation practices. But we are really just like seeking folks that we really believe in their practice. And we realize it's like, you know, over time we're like, oh, people see this as a gift to be asked to do a show, even if it feels kind of funny to show your work like at a bonfire at the beach or during a picnic at the park or anywhere else really. But those like kind of like small gestures feel really powerful when you see the community that gathers and how excited they are by everything that's happening. And ultimately just excited to be able to gather with all these other artists that they really love and care about.
And one of the things that I love about this project, Other Places Art Fair, is it's gathering a whole bunch of artist-run spaces who are then, you know, showcasing that the artists that they often work with. Can you talk about some of the artist-run spaces in San Diego? What's the culture like? What's the landscape? And what kind of work is happening there?
Truly, there aren't that many artist-run spaces around San Diego, but there are other projects that happen as well, right? Like a small publishing press that maybe is producing zines and participates in a lot of zine fests around the Southern California region, for example. Something that really excites me about artist-run spaces is that when artists are also hosting other artists, they just like really understand what it means to like dream within your practice. Something that Mika and I love to ask when we work with folks is like, oh, like, you know, you get to know them. Sometimes your curating is a means of like just getting to know or understand someone's work. But we also love to ask like, oh, and what are your dreams? Like whether we're being invited into a space for a collaboration like the Athenaeum or Two Rooms, which is run by Lizzie Seltzer, who's also participating. We just like love to know like, what are your dreams and how can we maybe help facilitate that as well? So I think with the artist-run projects and spaces around San Diego, I've always been so inspired because folks just like have sometimes ideas that I feel are a little bit beyond convention. Like it's going back into that unconventional space. Mm. And it's so exciting when I think folks take it there, or when it's like, oh, I have this idea for shows where it's just a series of things that pop up around the various beaches around San Diego. And it's really tapping into the very specific location we're at. San Diego is a space that has like a lot of beautiful outdoor locations. It has a lot of beautiful weather. And we're also very close to the border. So there's this also beautiful portion of the art scene where a lot of folks are in this cross-border space of working between San Diego and TJ. And I think that those moments are so, so beautiful. There's something I think about artist-run spaces where like your own ego gets pushed aside a little bit because you are hosting other folks and like getting to know them through that. And it feels maybe just less transactional, which I really love.
That was Kat Gunn, artist, curator, and co-organizer of Other Places Art Fair South, talking to KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans, who joins me now. Julia, welcome.
Hey, Jade. Thanks for having me.
Always great to have you here. So Other Places Art Fair South takes place Saturday at California Center for the Arts, Escondido. What can people expect?
Yeah, so there'll be booths, but not like the traditional art fair. It's going to be more like open and accessible, more like a table, I guess. But then a lot of installation art, things like sculptures, site-specific art pieces set up around the venue. There's one by artist Roman DeSalvo. It's like his grape maze that was installed years ago. And he planted like a grapevine and it is now grown across the whole courtyard. And he will also have other work there. There's other visual artists and art spaces from around the region that have brought their artists in. And also a pop-up of Japanese artists who are going to be part of the OPAF event in Tokyo. That's happening next month. Mm-hmm. So this is cool how this is part of this like growing global project.
Yeah.
It's all 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Saturday. Admission's free, though donations are accepted. And that will help sustain this kind of project for your future years.
It's definitely something you want to sustain. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's take a look at what else is happening in arts and culture this weekend. In visual art, Oceanside Museum of Art is opening an exhibit that combines art and the natural world. Is that right?
Yeah, this is artist Francisco Ame, who is the gallery director for The Front in San Ysidro, and also an incredible artist and musician. And this is his solo exhibition, and it's kind of a continuation of work that he first showed at Mesa College Art Gallery. That was, I believe, in 2023. And it came from his fascination with the canyons behind his house. And it's a lot of like found recordings, objects, clay from those canyons. It's the combination. It will look like this huge projected video projects, sculpture with sound recordings baked inside. So think like birdsong mixed with electronics. It's really incredible stuff. And he's also inspired by the idea of myth. And I think that is really nice inside of this like abstract stuff that's also rooted in nature. It just seems to really work. The exhibit opens Saturday at Oceanside Museum of Art. It'll be up through March 15th. And then the exhibition reception, save the date for this because Oceanside Museum does these a little while after the exhibit opens. That'll be November 22nd. And they usually throw a big party.
And there are a few options for early Dia de Muertos events this weekend. Where can we find some local festivities?
Yeah, so there's two big ones. City Heights, they're going to be set up at the Performance Annex and the Officer Jeremy Henwood Memorial Park. There'll be a whole bunch of performances, acts from the Old Globe, Fern Street Circus, San Diego Ballet, Aztec Dancers, Victoria Mariachi, just to name a few. This is Saturday from 11 to 6, and it's free. And then on Sunday, there's another big Dia de Muertos festival in the Barrio Logan Cultural District. So basically along Logan Avenue in the heart of Barrio Logan. They're having a ton of live performances also. There's three different stages. There'll be ofrendas, youth workshops, lowriders, and of course, food. And this is Sunday from 12 to 7, and it's also free.
So what's going on in live music this weekend?
So we have Kini Kini, a local salsa group. They're playing at Lulu's Jungle Room in the Lafayette Hotel. They're led by David Castaneda, a singer slash percussionist. As someone who was once a percussionist, I have to say that there's nothing I'm more impressed by when someone can play drums and sing at the same time. And we're listening to a track that they put out this summer. It's called Nome des la Espalda. The show is Friday night at Lulu's. There's two shows, one at 8 and then another at 10 p.m. for the night owls. And these are free shows as well. And there's always a bunch of people on the dance floor, especially for salsa shows. And then one more on my radar in indie rock, the Che Cafe, UC San Diego, has an all-ages Halloween event. It's their Halloween Mutual Aid Benefit. And this helps fund their mutual aid meal assembly project and also keeps their community fridge stocked. A bunch of bands are playing. Two-Headed Girl, Beth and the Baysides, and the Microblades, who we're listening to now. This is Bruise from their 2024 EP, Echoes from the Rumor Mill.
Is breaking and a quivering and a shaking by this pre-winter freeze. And the boys, they were dancing it on the creepies.
And this is an early show on Saturday. It's 5 p.m. And like all Che Cafe shows, it's all ages and a sober space. And if you come in costume, it only costs $5 to get in, or $10 if you don't have a costume. So that totally incentivizes wearing a costume, in my opinion.
I think so. Well, you can find details on these and more arts events on our website at kpbs.org. I've been speaking with KPBS arts reporter and host of the finest podcast, Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ted.
And the boys, they were dancing it on the queen bees.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
Here in Southern California, we know all too well the devastation wildfires can cause. That's why our mission is to stop the next one before it starts. I'm Brian D'Agostino, leader of SDG&E's Wildfire and Climate Science team, and we've built one of the most advanced wildfire prevention programs in the country with a team of world-class meteorologists using artificial intelligence and real-time weather data, all to help keep our communities safe. We're also building a stronger grid and using public safety power shutoff when necessary because, believe me, I've seen firsthand how unpredictable wildfires can be. But here at SDG&E, we face that uncertainty head on to help keep you safe. Learn more at sdge.com/wildfiresafety.